Hello, welcome to episode number 55 of Light the Eye, presented by the U of I Credit Union. I'm Scott Beatty.
And I'm Robert Rosenthal.
Right here in the Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning inside the Armory on the campus of the U of I, where things continue to be seemingly, Robert, a little quiet around here in mid-July.
Ghost town-ish?
But there's something very significant I saw.
In Champaign?
Yeah.
What's that?
Not only is there a very subtle scoreboard, almost complete, on the South Horseshoe at Memorial Stadium, but hanging from the crane today as I drove in was a light standard.
Yep.
Memorial Stadium has been without lights for the last little bit while they redo things. And so I just saw a bunch of lights dangling from a big crane. And it was actually kind of cool to see Memorial Stadium without lights for a moment, like it was back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when they added lights. When do you think lights were added? We need a historian on that.
Were there lights for athletic fields in 1924? Like, there wouldn't even have been the ability to add lights when it was built, right? What was the first night game in any sport? You know, I have this thing called Google. You talk about something interesting, and I will Google that.
Okay, well, I will tell you that if you're really enjoying the sounds of Robert Googling, please make sure to like and subscribe, or to leave a review. In fact, somebody tried to leave a review on the podcast on Apple and hadn't listened to an episode yet. Turns out they're onto that. So you actually need to listen. Engage with us and then leave an authentic review. Hopefully you authentically like it, and it really helps things out. But beyond that, if you could hit the like below, and of course, feel free to comment. We always appreciate our audience feedback. And we're grateful to our hosts inside the Center for Teaching and Learning inside the Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning here. And we're grateful to our producer today, Kendall Crawford. All right, what did you unearth?
The first night baseball game was in Independence, Kansas, in April of 1930.
Oh, okay, but I was thinking you were just looking at Illinois.
No, I was wondering if it was possible when the stadium was built to even have lights installed.
Well, they had electricity by then.
Right, but they didn't. There was no such a thing as, what if we put a bunch of lights up here and played at night? It was only daytime. I mean, there were famous games that ended because of darkness and that type of thing.
So, and then somebody said, what if we moved it to a Friday night or a Thursday night and we put it on television?
Yes. So the first college football game under lights, let's see here. In the 1893 Chicago's World Fair, they tested a night game. You know, what was that called? The Columbian Exposition?
Yeah.
One of their exhibits was the idea that in the future, sporting events would be played at night. But I don't see the date. Oh, first NFL game played at night was 1929. Okay. So, this was a useless exercise that I just went through. All just because my brain said, hey, that might be interesting, and it really isn't.
Haven't you based a whole career on a useless exercise?
Isn't my entire vibe useless information? Yes, it is. You know, we could into lighting the eye.
Do they have the capability? We could. But I want to tell you that we're going to talk with Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson. She is the new Illini women's tennis head coach. And one of the things I just want to underscore that we love to do here on Light the Eye is not only talk about football or basketball, but all the sports.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty cool, for me at least, because Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson is from Naperville, and she was a high school champion there, not once, not twice, not three times, but four times.
And we aligned this pretty good, that Wimbledon started during the dancer episode and ended yesterday, just before we record the Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson. It is tennis month here at Light the Eye.
But before we do that, let's do something we love.
That you couldn't do back in 1924.
Nobody knew how. Scientists had not yet invented a way.
Let us light the eye.
Last time we talked, we did a This Day in Scott Beatty History.
Yes.
Got another This Day in Scott Beatty History.
Hit me.
And it relates to Naperville. My anniversary.
Yes.
Actually, I should say it's my wife and I's anniversary.
Congratulations.
23 years today.
23 and me.
Yep. We... you don't need to be involved in the 23-year celebration, let me tell you.
Yes, you're welcome.
But we got married in Naperville, so this is just, you know, very... Of course, we both grew up there and met there, so very full circle moment. And
you know what I was contemplating the other day? This is God's honest truth. Probably I've been on a highway, though. I don't know if I've ever been to Naperville, Illinois in my life.
Well, we may have to change that.
Do you drive through Naperville on any of the interstates?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then I've been physically in Naperville. Yeah. But I don't know if I've ever gone to a location in Naperville.
We could take you on the Scott Beatty History Tour. Oh, there's plenty of sites to show you.
Similar to the Kramer, the reality tour, the Jerry Seinfeld reality tour?
Very much is. It might be even more boring.
Okay, good.
So, anyway, happy anniversary to my wife, Christina.
Happy anniversary to you. 23, that means you got married in 03?
We did. It was a Sunday. Let's, cheaper.
Let's think of the status of Illini Athletics. Just, let's see.
That is the filter at which you look at?
My entire life.
Yeah.
Self had just been hired. So, Bill Self was hired in April of 03? No, I'm sorry. Mm-mm. Weber had Weber. Just been hired.
There you go.
Yes, Self had just left for Kansas. That's what I'm trying to think of.
Yeah,
that was the fan standing outside the banquet trying to urge Bill Self to stay.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, I'm off to Kansas, dreaming of driving up Nath Smith Drive.
Well, I have another history. Look how we've gone. Can we get into our highlights?
Yeah, let's do it.
We need a thing for highlights.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need a sound effect
some type of a image or something. Music. Kendall, you got anything you can think of? Is there a maybe we should get him a soundboard over there so he can just hit the clong.
Exactly.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, time for highlights. Reports about Illinois men's basketball non-conference schedule getting filled out. Looks like the Illini will play. Of course, this hasn't been officially announced.
Sure.
But it looks like the Illini are expected to play Winthrop on November 23rd. And many of you, when you just heard me say that, or if you already saw the note about it out there, had some sort of visceral reaction to mm-hmm. that. Because Illinois has only played Winthrop one other time in history, and it was back in November of 2016. So it'll be 10 years and 2 days to the date of when Illinois last matched up with Winthrop. And why is that significant?
I mean, all I think about is the 5'9" dude. That's all I think
about. Do you
remember
his name?
No. There was a plethora of them. Miami had that 5'10" guy that beat us.
Keon Johnson.
How many do you have? Do you have the stats in front of you?
38 points.
Oh, good Lord.
15 of 21 shooting. And he only went to the free throw line 4 times. He went 4 for 4 from the line, 4 for 7 from distance.
Just completely destroyed us. It's one of those games, you know, there are those fans in the stands that will just, in their moment of frustration, just scream out, "Somebody guard him!" Like, you know, just the guttural reaction of, like, I know you're trying to do this, but someone please stop him. And that was one of those games. Lost in overtime?
Mm-hmm. 84-80. That was Illinois' first loss of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But many will... Well, let me ask you this. Can you remember the starting lineup?
It's a good quiz. Fall of...
2016.
16-17 season. So we're going to go LaRon Black.
Nope.
LaRon Black wasn't in the starting lineup?
He was not. He was in the game, though.
We're going, let's see. Is Brandon Paul still there?
Nope.
Hold on. Brandon Paul, he was done in 13. What am I thinking? Hold on. I've got to reset my brain here. I'm going to go Malcolm Hill.
Ding.
I'm going to go, That's the year Kendrick Nunn left, right?
He was not in the game.
Jaylon Tate, was he starting?
Ding.
Okay. Maverick Morgan?
Ding.
Not Laron Black.
No, but he came in off the bench.
Aaron Jordan would have been a freshman, but I don't think he's starting.
Nope. He played in the game. No points. Who have you said? Malcolm Hill, Jaylon Tate, and Maverick Morgan. All right. You've named two guards.
Aaron Cosby? Was that his year?
Nope.
Nope.
You need another guard, and you need another post player. Or wingish player.
Who was the guard we got for 1 year? Just give them to me. Just give them to me. This isn't good audio.
Free throws against Missouri.
Tracy Abrams?
There you go.
Oh, he was still. That's right. He had a sixth year.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Champagne's finest.
Michael Finke.
There you go.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay.
And Jalen Coleman lands in the Ron Black. Played the most bench minutes.
Got it.
But yeah, lost 84-80. And I think that might have been the first early indications that wasn't going to be a great season.
Yes.
Losing to Winthrop at home.
Yes. Because this was, Whitman had gotten the job.
Yep. It was Whitman's first year.
So this was Yeah, he didn't do anything in his first month. You know, he did with this football side, but he didn't do anything with Gross after that year, which was terrible, the 2015-16 season. And then it was like, okay, this is Gross's 1 year audition to keep the job, and he did not keep the
job. And Whitman notably said at the end of this year in spring of 2017, it was a difficult choice for him because he really liked John Gross.
Yes.
He could see what needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So I bring this all up. He's like, here we are, 10 years. It's kind of like in the last episode when we were reflecting with Tom Michael on the first game that Brad Underwood would coach in the fall of 17, an exhibition against EIU.
Mm-hmm.
Look how far we've come, baby.
Yes, look how far we've come. Those were, it was just so funny. All those games where we're losing to some single guard shorter than 6 foot tall.
Yeah. Okay, NBA Summer League. Keaton Wagler had himself a game the other day. Had 18 points in one quarter. That's a lot of points.
It's funny.
23.
It's funny for me digging into, just dipping my toe into NBA stuff because I'm not an NBA guy. I don't have a team. I don't really follow it. I mean, I enjoyed the Knicks run. I enjoyed following it from afar, but I don't really get into the nitty gritty of how these things go. And debates on NBA players are so definitive. You have to come with a statement of like, this rookie will be better than this rookie. You know, just watching clips of shows and this and that, there is no like, well, we'll see what's going to go on. Everybody's got to come with the take that is already set of like, I think Acuff is better than Wagler. I think Wagler is better than Fleming's. You know, like everybody just has to have a stance on everything. So you can't find information without trying to wade through like, here is the definitive answer. He should have gone this position with this.
Well, I'm with you. I'm not a deep NBA follower. If the Bulls get hot, I get interested.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been more interested through these years how are former Illini players performing.
Sure.
For however it's come about, the NBA is followed or marketed more around individuals as much as teams. I've known people like, I follow player X.
Yep.
So if they're on this team, then I'm for that team. As opposed to, I mean, obviously there's plenty of Suns fans, there's plenty of Mavs fans, there's plenty of Knicks fans, or whatever. But you seem to follow the individuals as much as you do the teams. But I saw some chatter. People think Wagner might fit into the starting lineup for the Clippers. I don't know if that's real or not.
Yeah.
Because I'm not like, a front office guy in the NBA or something, but or an NBA reporter even close to that. But I don't know. I just went, oh, that's nice. I assume the summer league, if you score 23 points in a summer league game, I assume that's sort of like baseball prospect so-and-so hit a home run in spring training. You're like, could it mean you go, well, he's going to make the team?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Wagler is a lottery pick. He's making the team.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I get the baseball basketball analogy sort of breaks down pretty quick here.
Right.
I'm saying it's not nothing to score 23 points. I just don't want to over. It just I'm just enjoying it for what it is.
Yeah. It's interesting how the whole idea of draft a 19-year-old kid and give him a few years to develop, again, just my observation as an NBA outsider, it seems much more heightened of we need to have a really good idea in the next 2 years whether he's a foundational piece kind of thing. Like, there is no, like, they took a chance on a freshman from high school. You know, this is like, this is a, we need to know exactly what you're going to be 18 months from now. And, you know, by the end of these next 18 months, we need to know exactly what we have here so we can make our decisions moving forward of how we build our roster and whether we're tanking or whether we're this or whether we're that. So,
but it's also curious. I mean, Keaton Wagner's doing what he is now for the Clippers. What they said when he was drafted is we saw him last summer, meaning now-ish, mm-hmm. and knew then.
Yeah.
We knew then. This is before we all knew. I'd heard rumblings like, oh, mm-hmm. the coaching staff, the NBA people are kind of high on Keaton Wagner, so watch out. But I think he's still even surprised at that. You know, nobody said, yeah, there's a guy that's going to go get 46 in Mackey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's interesting to think that right now there's probably NBA people visiting this month or within the next few weeks that are going to look at summer workouts at Illinois and decide about certain freshmen and go, yep.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to keep it quiet or whatever they're going to do, but they mm-hmm. may know right now. Don't need to see anymore.
Mm-hmm. I remember being at a Camp Randall practice. Matt Lacoste was a sophomore tight end, and I think it was the Giants scout following him around. And he hadn't made the rotation here yet or anything else. I just noticed that this NFL scout is zeroed in on one guy at camp. And that stuff is fascinating to me that some, you know, he ended up playing for the Giants and had, you know, scored a couple touchdowns. That was a Monday night game or whatever and this and that. It's always fascinating to see how the scouts, I mean, that's their job, right? Discover a kid. They're like, hey, Illinois has this 19-year-old tight end who might not play for a couple years, has all the measurables. I watched him up close in drills. His hips are flexible enough, all the stuff that they're looking for and this and that. And that, you know, before even the media is telling you, hey, this guy might make the rotation next year, this and that. These scouts are like, we know what we're looking for, and that's the height and the size and the hands and everything else. So we sent a scout to some camp in Rantoul, Illinois, to check him out and put him on our board. It's crazy.
Okay, the baseball draft was over the weekend. And congratulations to former Illini pitcher Zach Bates. He was the closer in the 2025 season, all Big Ten pitcher. Missed this past year with injury. Actually, it was reported that he went into the portal and was going to go to Nebraska, but he was drafted in the 20th round by the Dodgers. I presume he'll have a choice to make on that. In this day and age of NIL, I would think, not maybe a ton of money in the 20 as a 20th round pick, but it's also your chance to go be a pro and see what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where he'll go, but really enjoyed following him and seeing him pitch, and you know, very likable guy. It was tough from an Illinois perspective to see him go in the portal, but that's what happens these days. Then the other undrafted free agent signing, Reagan Hall, who was the anchor of the rotation this past year in his junior season. Loved watching a good lefty pitcher with movement. Bittersweet for me because I was already dreaming of him being back in the rotation as a senior,
mm-hmm.
With him and Aiden Flynn and whoever else you move as, you know, have as a third starter or whatever order there.
Mm-hmm.
But good for Reagan.
Yep. And isn't baseball like
Albuquerque, New Mexico?
Like junior year is kind of senior year for baseball, right? Often, right? Like, yeah. It's a 3-year kind of sport, and the fourth is a bonus or yeah. whatever. So
could change depending on could happen. You could go sooner now, depending on how some proposed changes sure. go with this new labor agreement and that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's our big highlights. But I may have buried the lead.
What's that?
Well, in the open, right before the Open, when we started it, the scoreboard is going up.
Yes.
Next month is the annual family movie night that they host at Memorial Stadium, where people can come out and watch a movie, sit on the Memorial Stadium turf. The movie is going to be Air Bud.
Mm-hmm.
This is the choice of David Mirkovich.
Of course. You ready for my statement on that?
Yeah.
I've never seen Air Bud.
Neither have I. I know it's a dog in basketball.
Look at us. Look at us. I thought it would be more your generation. Like, you're like 6 or 7 years younger than me.
Yeah, but that doesn't
matter. Air Bud came, it was like mid-90s, right?
Well, you're asking a guy that's never seen it.
You know, they make this thing called Google.
Can't just sit and wonder. We're going to have live Googling in this episode.
That's right. Air Bud came out in 1997, August 1 of 97.
Yes, I'm told it's...
Never seen it.
Yeah. I mean, I may be committing several cardinal sins of omission here, but I have not seen Air Bud. I've not seen Space Jam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, are you good with Air Bud and David Mirkovich? Here's the other thing.
If Merck wants to watch Platoon, I'm good with that for family movie night. He can do whatever he wants. He is the current king of campus.
Yeah.
Apocalypse Now.
Top 10 worst family movie nights to debut the new largest scoreboard in college football.
The horror.
Bring your kids. Spread out on a blanket and let's all settle in for fill in the blank worst movies only.
Yeah, he can have whatever he wants.
Okay,
he's Merck.
We're not going to denigrate ourselves, though. We're not going to spiral into that common denominator debating sports movies and which are the best, right?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. I can tell you one of the worst, though.
Okay, hit me.
Rudy.
Yeah, I mean it's okay. But it's all about Notre Dame, so who likes that?
That's not a reason to hate it.
That's absolutely a reason to hate it. What's right. Your most watched sports movie? Let's just throw it out right now.
Most watched sports
movie. Most beloved, most watched, whatever. What's your movie in the sports
genre? Well, I mean, you got to understand, in Sandlot, the hero becomes a baseball announcer. The narrator, at least.
Sure.
So that's automatic. Yep. But I do like the baseball movies. Field of Dreams, The Natural.
Yeah. On Field of Dreams. I mean, obviously for a guy whose dad passed away when he was, I was 20 years old, you know, that's going to be the movie. But Field of Dreams will forever be number one for me.
Yep.
Can't watch it without sobbing. Maybe we should watch that on the field and have a bunch of grown men crying out on the Memorial Stadium turf.
Okay. Kendall Gill. In town, he has his annual golf outing this time of year for the Cunningham Children's Home. Great cause, by the way, helping kids in need here in the Champaign-Urbana area. But I just saw a clip online of him discussing there's now three, I'll call them modern Final Four teams in Illinois basketball history and to debate about who is the greatest, and of course Kendall was on one of them, the Flying Illini, and he maintains that that is the best of the three. Care to weigh in on that now that we have a new Final Four team in the mix?
Because they were one seeds and this was a three seed, I think it would be hard to say that 26 would beat 05 or 89. So I have to have them third, this past season third. I go back and forth as to who would win again. I mean, you could take the out of, like, basketball style was different, and it was all 12-foot jumpers in 1989, and how would this team do against this when the three-point line became so important and all that. Right now, because Nick Anderson is directly over your shoulder on that little poster in the corner, because, yes, bring it into the shot. There you go. Because of Nick Anderson there, I'm going 89. And that has a lot to do with the fact that I was a 15-year-old impressionable kid who thought Kenny Battle and Nick Anderson and Kendall Gill ruled the entire planet.
I would give the nod to 89 also. I was only 9 years old, but I just think at the end, a slight edge... And truth be told, Kent Brown, in his book, 100 Things Every Illini Fan Should Know and Do Before They Die, also gives a slight edge And obviously it's totally subjective, but I think at the end of the day, the aggregate talent amongst the rotation was slightly better in 89. And I mean, just the number of like great, I mean, Kendall Gill and Nick Anderson, especially, both had really good NBA careers.
Yes.
05, the starting lineup all at least had a cup of coffee in the NBA, right?
Yep.
I mean, you had talent. There's nobody arguing about who, that anybody was untalented. Last year's team was also very talented and just saw a lottery pick depart. Kylan Boswell just got a two-way. Like, there's all future pros there.
Yep. I think...
I just think there's a, just a tick there above in the 89 Illini.
Yeah, and I think the you're right. The depth... I can't believe I'm going to resurface these wounds. We saw the depth issue of the 05 team in the title game when James Augustine only played 11 minutes and fouled out. Jack Ingram played great in that game, but then nobody could fill Jack Ingram's role, which was, you know, so necessary in that long run.
Yeah.
And when it was like a six-man team, it was like one guy gets in foul trouble and yeah. Oh,
yeah, but I'm just even considering just who was in the rotation, the six or seven guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the 05 team. Maybe it's just because I'm an old guy, but yeah, I lean 89.
Well, just because you love the 80, lean 89 doesn't mean you don't love 05.
That's a good point. Love all my children. I do have one thing.
Okay.
I did some scouting this weekend. I can't say where I did some scouting. About the long jump. Found a few locations where it could possibly be done. Have to be careful. I'm not going to be jumping any fences into high school athletic facilities. I don't want to be that guy. But I did. Kendall, when did I? When did I commit to? It'll be in the next month. Do you remember when that was? That was like a month ago. That was like the 12th, right?
I have absolutely no clue. Every time we hop on this podcast, you just keep delaying.
Exactly.
It seems like
exactly.
You're not having any faith in yourself, Robert. You know?
Okay, so I say all of this because it is going to be done this week. It's going to happen this week.
Look,
I can't tell you.
You
where, can't tell you when. I will have somebody film it, but it will be done this week.
Okay, and again, $77.
Mm-hmm. He pledged. He dropped a Benjamin on the whole thing. So it's technically right now. Well, I have other people on Slack who said they would contribute. I'll have to find out what those totals are. But thus, yes, as of right now, it's $177 to one charity or the other.
Yeah.
If I make it, it goes to my charity. If I don't make it 10 feet, it goes to your charity.
Yes.
And I'll find that what that full total is tonight or tomorrow, and then you will see a
video.
Well,
I think other people may want to contribute as well when they hear about this.
Yes. Just email us at lighttheipodcast@gmail.com and we'll add you to the list if you want to participate. We'll find some way to do that.
Yeah, or comment below if you're on YouTube.
Yes. And it's all going to charity, and we're going to see if I can jump 10 feet.
Okay. By the way, just something keeping your eye on. Keep your eye on. Not a line I exactly. But your friends over there in Ann Arbor, Michigan, are going to have a little meeting on Thursday. The Board of Trustees over there are going to look at some documents about it, an internal investigation about Michigan. And there is speculation and rumors swirling about Ward Manuel, the athletic director, who has already put out a statement that's saying, I have not had any conversations. I expect to be the AD going forward. Well, that seals it.
This feel any more like 2016 and...
That's because here's what happened.
2015 and Bill Cubitt.
Yes and no. Some coaching departures for different reasons. So Dusty May just left Michigan to take an NBA job.
Yes.
Right now, there's no scandal behind that. That is just a guy who's wants to go to the NBA now. I just won myself an NBA or an NCAA championship. Thank you very much. I'm going to go coach in the NBA. You could maybe read into more than, but I don't know anything more than just that face value thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what do? They have promoted Mike Boynton. And he used to be at Oklahoma State, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He was a long time Underwood
assistant. So you got to put an interim tag on somebody when the head coach leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took that tag off and gave him a whopping 2-year deal.
Identical to?
Bill Cubitt.
Yes.
Now, Bill Cubitt took over in the wake of a scandal firing.
Oh, a scandal firing of a football coach. Has that happened at Michigan?
Yes, but this is a different sport. This is basketball. Mm-hmm. And the coach didn't leave under us. The previous football coach, the previous coach, that is, Jim Harbaugh, left after a national championship and then
under scandal? Weird.
He was just taking a pro job, you know.
Yes, yes.
Oh, by the way, he's not allowed to coach in college for, you know.
I'm saying is that the when they announced 2 years, my first reaction, I put it on Twitter. My first reaction is like, okay, well, this is a Cubitt situation. They don't have the guy to hire the next guy, so they gave the interim a 2-year tag to kick the can down the road, not a dagger to the heart of the program. It's not ideal, but it's not a dagger to the heart of the program. And they are just kicking the can down the road so that the next guy can hire the actual basketball coach that they want. So they only give this guy a 2-year deal. That's, you know, that was what it all smelled like when they only give Boynton a 2-year deal and they didn't do an actual search. It's like, oh, well, then maybe they don't want that guy to do the search. And now these things come out. So seems I'm shocked that he's made it this far. I mean, you list out the number of scandals. I mean, we're not even talking about the Michigan football coach that was accessing student photo accounts on his website, who was arrested, and I don't know if he's in jail right now. Like, he was using his Michigan football coach to try and get into co-ed's accounts. Like there are so many scandals under Manuel, but they won a basketball title and they won a football title, and I guess that fixes all scandals.
It can in the eyes of some people. And I don't like that it does.
Yes. But surprised.
There may be a reckoning coming. Yeah. I don't know. I'm following, you know, there's plenty of national reporters that are keeping an eye on this. So yes. Just be interested to see how this whole thing develops.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, maybe the Board of Regents or whatever would say, like, well, it's really hard to fire an AD who delivered a football title in 23 and a basketball title in 26. But the just based on what happened with Sherrone Moore and the on-campus knife incident and all this stuff, on top of all the other scandals that have been happening, is usually at most every school when a board steps up and like, I think we need to, let's just clean house real quick. Let's just start a new thing. ADs don't last forever. Some ADs only go 5 or 6 years. Let's maybe move in a different direction. This is a little too much.
Mm-hmm. That is essentially why the house was cleaned at Illinois.
Yes, yes. And now
for
you have...
For far less.
And so the fact that this guy is hung on through, maybe it just took the titles to do that, but the fact that this guy is hung on through coaching scandal after coaching scandal after coaching scandal, and not just coaching scandals, like very public arrests and everything else. And it's pretty amazing. And it sounds like, according to reports today, that it's all coming to an end.
Okay. We're going to visit with Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson when we come back. Newly named Illini women's tennis head coach. Evan Clark announced his retirement a few months ago, and the search went on, and they found a Naperville product. Mm-hmm. And a very good tennis player, very good collegiate player, good pro player, and a good coach, Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson. We're going to get to know her a little bit, maybe talk a little Naperville.
It's too bad people won't get to hear it because so many people clicked stop the moment we both said we've never seen Air Bud. So...
But sorry, these are the true believers. Yes. And I have a Naperville tie-in, too, before we're done.
With Air Bud?
No, with Illinois and the whole thing.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Look forward to it.
Light the Eye, brought to you by Logic Co-working at the corner of St. Mary's and Neal in Champaign. It's the ideal workspace for you to get something done, whether it's for a one-day task or an indefinite amount of time as a remote worker. There's a bright and welcoming environment for you, and members can enjoy 24/7 access to their best-in-class amenities. my sister is in town along with my brother-in-law for the week, and they're getting work done at Logic Coworking. They heard about it right here on Light the Eye, and it's a great environment for you to be inspired, to connect, or to be in a distraction-free zone. If you're just doing a short-term option, there's day passes available, or, like I said, there's 24/7 access whenever you need, and take advantage of fast Wi-Fi, printing, office supplies, and a kitchen. Logic Co-working at the corner of Neil and St. Mary's, your place to get something done. Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson is our guest. Last month, she was named as the new women's tennis head coach at the University of Illinois, the ninth in program history. She succeeds Evan Clark, who announced his retirement a little while ago. She is an alum of the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, where she was a standout player as well as a great pro career. And she's had coaching stops, among others, at Oregon, and most recently was the head coach at the University of Illinois, Chicago, where she was the Missouri Valley Coach of the Year this past year. She is, maybe most importantly, a native of Naperville, Illinois, and albeit at a tick below in status high school at Naperville Central, but she's here now in our Light the Eye studio. Elizabeth, congratulations and welcome, and I'm only slightly kidding about Naperville Central.
Oh, thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Yeah, congratulations. It at least took us by surprise when Evan announced that he was stepping away from coaching. How quick was this process for you to become the head coach at University of Illinois?
Yes, yeah, so I did cross paths with Evan a couple times, actually, when I coached at Oregon and then just regionals here as well. He was always super professional, really kind, a great coach. And even as I was interviewing, I asked a lot of competitors actually against Illinois, what was your sense with what the team is like? I just wanted to know what the student athletes were like currently. And they all said, you know, great fighters, never give up, really good athletes, super gritty, and also really versatile. So they know how to make you uncomfortable. They're really well coached. So I think that's just a nod to, you know, previous coaches and to Coach Clark, just how great a job they did with really great student athletes that also are great competitors.
Coaches are used to making quick changes in their careers. That's just how it goes. We move from one place to another very quickly. So was it okay, this is here, this is an opportunity, and we have to decide in short order if this is what we want to do?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I was anticipating to be at UIC for a longer period of time, but also feel like sometimes with opportunities, I say it's the plane is taking off and you have to get on or it's going to keep going. And so, you know, we definitely were very thoughtful, and I think that's a great piece, too, of just when you get an opportunity like this, making sure we know we're doing this for the right reason and that it fits into our long-term picture. And I told, you know, Josh as well, we always want these changes to be a win for the career, but also a win for the family, and that it's a great fit for us. And so we're excited for that. We are teaching our kids new cheers. They're working on it. So we had to run through that a bit. But, you know, it's great to be adaptable and to have these opportunities come up is important. And even for my husband, he actually is the one that did two round trips from Oregon to Illinois, towed a car, a trailer, and through in the fall where we were worried about weather. So when he heard Champaign, he's like, oh, that's a piece of cake compared to that. So so that definitely makes it a little bit smoother transition, not having such a great distance to have to go.
This is maybe there's a lot of circumstances when new coaches come in. It could have been after, you know, somebody got fired, somebody retired, somebody, you know, whatever. So this is, you're not coming in on what I would say, you know, in a tumultuous situation by any means. It's just a kind of a natural something happened. Evan steps away, he wants to be done, and so you inherit it. So does that feel like it's much easier when it comes to, okay, I'm going to meet the players and set a course here?
I think what I usually say, and even seeing as an assistant, seeing head coach transition when I was at Oregon and then also into UIC, is just anticipating that even if you're the perfect coach, that for any group, that change can be difficult, and just because it's something new. And so I think the biggest part for players and just what I found with my teams is that if you follow through in terms of what your expectations are or what things that you've set the standards, it's really more about creating the trust from a reliability standpoint. And even if they don't necessarily agree with that in the moment, it's just more more of that trust of knowing, okay, they said this is how we'll operate and that's how we'll operate. And so I think that's been something that I really appreciate and have seen in transitions that have been successful. And even at UIC, the team was extremely open to things that were different. And so when I talked with this group as well, I was like, you know, I'm a very logical person. I want to talk with, you know, your coaching staff and you all about what are things that are working. And obviously if it works well in my style, we'll do it, but there might be times that we make a change. But whenever I'm challenging them or challenging them to be out of the box a little bit, that it's the intention is always to make them better or to do what's best for the program. And so I think just reminding them of that. Another conversation I've had with players too is just, I would say even for my time at UCLA, there were pieces where I was in and out of the lineup at 6 and 7. And so probably as a coach, I'm a little bit more open than a lot of coaches are about information as to why we're doing a certain load management, you know, with strength and conditioning, or why we're doing things with lineup, as long as it's appropriate and not, you know, confidential information, but usually relatively an open book. And so I think that just helps players know your thought process, know that we took a lot of time and thought to look into this and think about, you know, the benefits and the consequences of decisions. And so I think that, again, just helps them feel like they're well taken care of and that we're really, you know, being really intentional with how we do things.
So when you're a player at UCLA, and when you're an assistant coach at Oregon, did you ever imagine, you know, you come back to Illinois, you're the head coach at Illinois, and you're going to be playing against UCLA and Oregon and the West Coast teams? I mean, it's such a strange thing with a national conference now.
No, it's been really interesting with the transition, and I left Oregon prior, you know, to the conference change, so knew what that was coming, what that was looking like. And like I said, even when we were really thoughtful about the decision, talked to coaches about what's the travel like as you're leading this program, what are things that you see and, you know, things that you need to manage now. And so just, it's been great actually having familiarity with those schools, not only the level, but I think just, you know, even playing on those surfaces, or, you know, at least it's like, oh, when we go to SUCLA, oh, we're going to have one hotel right in the middle. It's equidistant from both. And even logistically, I think it's nice just having a little bit of familiarity with those schools and how to compete against them. I think a great thing too at Oregon, and this is a similar piece here where, you know, great electric energy from an athletic standpoint, obviously an incredible academic institution here. And so that was always one big thing, even at Oregon, we're trying to really push making history, and just throughout my career. So I think as a player, not only in high school, but just going even to UCLA, as I wanted to win a national championship as a player, was a big goal. And then as a coach too, just trying to be really supportive of our players, of it's okay to be ambitious, and we're going to go after goals that have not been accomplished before. And if we don't make it the first time, that's okay. We take it as information, and then you grow and figure out how you can do it the next year. So it's a great opportunity. I'm excited for it. And it is nice having some familiarity with some of the old stomping grounds.
So when you were being recruited, so you were a four-time state champ in Illinois, right? You won as a freshman and won as a sophomore, junior, senior. You probably had your choice of anywhere, and obviously UCLA tennis and the chance to win a national title and this and that. Okay, so for the next you in Chicago, how can you know, what's your pitch to recruit her to here?
I think, and this is actually a lot of student athletes have told me, not only with tennis, but other places. And now even as a coach, I can really relate just in the interview process, as almost every single one has said, it feels like home, like Illinois is home. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a big piece for athletes where, and truly for their parents as well. I think that's a really big piece of the recruiting aspect. I know obviously a lot of student athletes are independent now, or they're working with people that are trying to help them play somewhere for scholarships, but really I think a lot of that family support network is that you're 18 to 22 years old typically, and it's your first time being away from home, even if you're from the Chicago suburbs or if you're from around the world, but that this place is really dedicated to making sure that you're supported as a student and as an athlete, and that you're prepared to do great things, but also be ready for post-graduation, whatever that looks like. And so, I mean, it was really evident even in my interview process and how I could see people talk about Josh and the department, that it wasn't just talk, that they truly felt like, no, like they will make sure that that you transition well, that you have what you need, that you have people that you can go to if you need answers. And so I've seen that the same thing for athletes. So I think that's the big piece of just, hey, it's going to be your home here, and we're going to take great care of you, and we're going to make history while we do it.
Yeah. Did you consider Illinois? Like you said you were thinking national title, and obviously a player of your caliber in high school, that's, you know, it's tough. Did you visit consider, or, you know, what was your relationship with Illinois when you were a student athlete?
So I did take an unofficial visit to Illinois, and then most of my visits were East and West Coasts, but took unofficial to Northwestern and here. And really at the time, I was ready to spread my wings a bit, and so I wanted to go East or West Coast. Had a great family support network, so great relationships with my parents too, and so I just felt like this is probably a important part of my growing up and maturing, of having being independent and having to be away a little bit more. So was really looking primarily East and West Coast. So like Vanderbilt, Georgia Tech, Stanford, and UCLA were some of the primary like official visits, but and UNC. But it was great to see different styles. And I think that's where too, just remembering the unique things about Illinois is important. And just I think that balance also, like we said, that electric energy from fans and students, and how that's really neat to see at a highly achieving academic institution. And one thing I really appreciate is just also being able to collaborate. I mean, you have these world-renowned professors here. So there's, even though we have great support staff that are have expertise all across with, you know, sports psychology or a different nutrition and all that too, it's a really neat avenue to be able to go to professors. And if there's studies that correlate that can help our program get better and help the research as well, like that's just a great crossover as well.
Okay, Scott, I'm going to start a timer. You get 5 minutes of Naperville talk. You're limited to five. Starting now.
A couple episodes ago, we had Brad Dancer on, and Robert talked extensively about his high school tennis career. So this would be a good time to compare our high school tennis careers. Mm-hmm. As he just mentioned, you won 4 individual state titles in a row. I, at rival high school Naperville North, did not make the freshman team after trying out for it. So there you go.
Pretty much identical high school careers.
Actually, I have a serious question about that. At the time when you were winning them, with all due respect to your opponents, did you just feel like, I am just the better player out here? Was it just a talent gap? Because we just got done with Wimbledon, right? And I saw a note, 10th winner at Wimbledon in the last 10 years. There's not been right now in professional tennis, or at least at Wimbledon, there's not been somebody that's just grabbing hold and going to be the dominant player right now. My question is, like, how hard was that to go out and win a state title and then do it again and again and again? You know, was it just a matter of, yeah, you were really good, or was it like a mental, I knew how to win?
It was a really actually interesting experience. I think one, similar to here, felt really supported by my high school and my team, because I was really nervous coming in as a freshman, knowing, okay, I'm probably going to play one on varsity, and how will I be accepted by my peers, and being, you know, a freshman in that situation. But they were so great and super welcoming and really open, even with the coaches. When I was at practice, I would obviously be practicing with the team, but then sometimes I got to help like run a court and do a drill with them or things like that too. And so that they were really open to that, of just even accepting information from me. So I think one, that made it a great experience of why I wanted to stay in it all 4 years. It was never a goal initially to win 4 state championships. I was always very present, and we had a lot of really nationally ranked top talent. I mean, people that ended up being all Americans. It was not easy at all, like a really competitive field. And actually something that was interesting, it'd be interesting to see if I do this as a parent, but my parents actually would not let me read any newspaper articles through the season.
Interesting.
So even at high school, sometimes a teacher would give me one or anything like that, and we just kept it in a file basically. And after the state tournament was over, I was allowed to read it at that point. But my dad and my mom are really big on just, you know, trying your best and working hard and doing the things that are the best for you, you know, as a student and as an athlete, and not to really focus on that piece. And so I even remember as a freshman, I think I gave myself a little pep talk even in the bathroom mirror, and I was like, you know, you're playing someone older, like, hey, this probably isn't gonna go your way, like just go out and play and just kind of accept it and try to release a little bit the expectation. And so it definitely was not where I was going and thinking, you know, I'm elite and dominant, I just gotta wrap up business. So it was a really neat experience to have that as a prep athlete, because especially in individual sport, you typically didn't have as much recognition in terms of in newspapers or with TV coverage. And so it was a great way to highlight, you know, Naperville Central, but also just how great my team was. I mean, they were always there, you know, on the weekend to support me. And so I just really appreciated that experience too.
I mean, I guess maybe because I'm a failed tennis player, like I know, I at least have a sense of tennis is so hard mentally. It's just you and that other person, and there's the physical execution. But, you know, The Inner Game of Tennis was the big book that came out about how to, like, get out of your own way mentally. And did you carry on what you described there in your high school days into your college days and into your coaching about whatever it takes between the ears to – what you described to me sounds like I'm just sort of taking this as it comes. You know, you didn't have to do a lot of self-talk. I mean, is that accurate, and is that something you bring into even to coaching now?
So I think I definitely evolved from the sports psychology standpoint of learning to actually be a little bit maybe that feistier competitor actually in college tennis. The self-talk sometimes was normally positive, but out loud. So I remember when people went to my matches at UCLA, they're like, who is she talking to down there at the fence? And my husband now, who I was dating in college, he's like, oh, she's just talking to herself. That's just what she does. And so normally it was very positive, like, oh, you can do this. Next point, you know, right here, those types of things. But I learned to be, I think, a little bit more confident as a, quote, fighter or competitor in college of just like, no, like, I'm going to win if you put me out there, and putting in the work where I felt like I could actually truly confidently saying that, even though my parents were so definitely pushed and just talked about being, you know, humble and all those things. So I think I found another gear of competitiveness in college. And then when I was on the pro tour, I mean, that part I just learned to be really adaptable. And my goal was to make a Grand Slam, never made it, but just learned so many lessons through that, and where obviously your routine and doing things that you can control is really important. But also, like, sometimes you make the doubles final and then you have to go on a bus to Mexico City and you'd be ready to play the next morning. And so if you get too caught up and I have to have these controlled elements for me to compete my best, then it harms almost your ability to compete well. So I think just that adaptability I learned as well. And even as a coach now, I think with our players, sometimes there's something that they might feel like, oh my gosh, this is such a big problem. And we definitely don't want to undermine their feelings about something. We want to validate it. But also I'm like, hey, like, we can deal with this. Like, I've seen bigger problems. It's okay. And so just giving that sense of like, there's always something where we can find a way, we can work together, we can figure it out. And so I think that was a big thing as a competitor. And I think also, I think with female student athletes, but also just in general with athletes, I found later in my coaching career, and even for myself, a lot of times there is, if they're finding some type of pattern that they're getting into, whether it's competitively, maybe it's, you know, they win the first set, but then they tend to lose the second set, or just there tends to be things that are recurring for an athlete. And a lot of times it stems from some like deeper, not consequence, but something that's a bit deeper in their psyche. Sometimes it is about, you know, is it image? Is it proving to your parents? Is it showing that you really are good because maybe you were a little bit of a late bloomer? And so if we are able to really have pretty open and like vulnerable discussions about that, a lot of times that's when they make their big breakthrough.
Does that, I mean, sports psychology has blossomed or exploded, whatever the word you want, grown, has become such a significant part of athletes' development now. Is that, I mean, are you playing psychologist with your players now? Are you getting help with other people? Because, again, tennis to me is deeply psychological, because you just really almost have nobody out there to accept yourself and your own head.
Yeah. See, I think one is just having really good built trust with your players as well, so they can even feel safe enough to be honest and open about things that maybe are harder to say or truly what they're thinking. And then I think another thing is, it's not always me. Like, so I think it's also about finding who are the right people that speak to them that they can relate to. I've had players where maybe they wanted to speak to someone in their native language, so I reached out to a pro player on tour that could talk to them in their native language. I've had ones where they weren't really comfortable expressing it verbally, but they would write it to me. So they would write down what they were thinking. We even did it on changeovers. I'm like, hey, just tell me, write down in the journal what you're thinking, and then I'm going to take a peek, and then that way I can tell you on the changeover, you know, what we want to focus on. So I think it's one of just kind of unlocking that key a bit of like what really works for them, and not having the ego that the solution doesn't have to be me. I think that's a great thing at Illinois. You have so many just like staff members and coaches, and just even with your own coaching staff too, of just there's different personality styles. So it's really just about, okay, who can really connect with this player to help them be in that spot. And I think also sometimes there is a difference with a head coach versus assistant coach. Sometimes student athletes just feel little bit more comfortable being more open with an assistant coach. So there is an element of when you're deciding playing time and lineup and those things of sometimes wanting someone that's separate that doesn't make those decisions be able to talk with a player. But one exercise that's been really interesting, and there's a sports psychologist that we worked with in the past that it's been a really useful exercise, is that we'll write something called a RUT, which is a raw unfiltered thought. So you can do it before matches. I've had players even do it before big interviews after they graduate. And so you literally write what's on your mind. And it can be, I've told them, you know, you can swear, you can say coach is annoying, you can say literally whatever, anything is there. And then if you want to share it with me, I'll read it. If not, it's really meant to just get the thoughts out, see what's actually true. Like, sometimes it's amazing what you say to yourself and you're like, oh my gosh, when you actually see it written, it's amazing to see it. And then at the end, you basically draw a line and then you say, okay, I kind of accept these thoughts, but now here's what I'm going to focus on moving forward in this competition. So maybe I'm a freshman and I'm super nervous about my first Big Ten match. Like, okay, why are you nervous? Like, talk about where is it coming from? And then that way you can kind of lock into, okay, these worries that I have are not legitimate. Like, my teammates are going to love me no matter what. My coach is going to support me no matter what. So like, I get to just go out and have fun. And I'm just going to focus on being loud and connecting with my teammates. And that's a way for you to kind of move through that and not get stuck in something that maybe is not helping you perform the best.
I can now present to you the other side of sports psychology. Freshman year of high school, freshman tennis team playing doubles with my friend Jeff. I believe I set a world record, or we set a world record. I double faulted 7 times in one game, and we won the game. So, like, double fault, won the point, double fault, won the point, double fault. And then it was like, deuce head out, because mm-hmm. I kept double faulting on the ad court. So I don't
so
know.
You're very resilient, is what you're telling
you
me.
See, I needed you as my coach. He and I have joked about it for years of like, he's like, you would double fault, then I'd save you. You would double fault, then I'd save you. But maybe it was a resilience that I dug deep and found something to get that ninth serve in or whatever. But yes, I can identify with that just even as a tiny little high school tennis player. I've always told people, it's the sport you can get in your head the most, maybe even more than golf. There is nothing tougher than a 30, 40 second serve of, you know, the thought of don't screw this up can ruin a tennis player, because the moment you try to not screw up, it's over. Or you send the easiest, weakest serve in history just to get it in and it gets pounded. So that's all fascinating stuff for me. And I think I don't even have a question in there. I just know that I needed you as my mental coach, because we didn't cover that in Southern Illinois in the late 80s back in back in my day.
Basically, this interview is just you coaching us, helping
yes.
us through our.
Yes.
We're going to just put our ruts out and let you
yes.
let you react.
Maybe we should do that.
Whatever Pause, works.
Do 5 minutes of hey. Ruts.
Robert hasn't gotten over double faulting 7 times.
Yeah. It's a great story. We won the game.
But do I get stoppage time on Naperville? Because
yes, we, yes. You know, no, you're fine. Yes, yeah. they were. There's injury time here. Go ahead.
Okay. We got to just love on Naperville for a moment, if that's all right. Riverwalk, favorite places?
Oh, gosh. So actually, one place that we've recently gone, and on Mondays they have good deals as well, is Giamia's downtown Naperville. So, and it's actually, my kids love the grilled chicken too, so it's a win-win for everyone.
Didn't exist when I was there.
So that's one place that I would say has been a more regular, but there's so many great places there.
Maybe I should do this with the two of you, like best cup of coffee. If I need a cup of coffee, I know you're a coffee guy. If I need a cup of coffee in Naperville, where should I go?
Normally, I don't make it that far. Usually, the best cup of coffee is the quickest to your hand.
Yes.
So that tends to be at home. That's a tough one. My uh-huh. husband, he's in physician assistant school at Midwestern, so okay. he probably would know the best coffee spot. So I'll do more research on that.
There you go.
Pete's coffee is just fine
okay.
to me.
All right. It's yeah, you're Ogden that Avenue. Guy. You just need warm cup in your hand.
Well, I'm a step above gas station coffee.
Yes. Yes.
I'm a step. But the Riverwalk, was it a place you spent time at? Grown up?
We did. And
it's right next to Naperville Central.
No, it is. No, it's a super pretty area. Now it's been, I think that's been something I've really enjoyed too, is just I got to explore, obviously, Illinois and Naperville and Chicago and all these places in Illinois growing up as a young adult and as a kid, because we moved here when I was in kindergarten. And so now getting to see other aspects of it, too, with my kids, like, just never realized how amazing the library is until you go there and see all the things that we can do there with your little ones, and just explore it in a different way, too, from a different perspective. So it's truly been, you know, a great place to be and to come back and visit to as and well.
There are what, three high schools? How many high schools are there? North, Central, five-ish. And Neuqua? Is it Neuqua? Neuqua?
Neuqua.
Neuqua Valley.
Matea and Waubonsie, and then Bennett Academy. He's in Lyle, but that's kind of, you know, that's the parochial school.
Right there, yeah.
And that is really good at athletics also, so.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when I'm a freshman here, you meet somebody from one of those massive high schools. And it's like, yeah, I graduated 570 people in my high school graduating. How many were in your graduating class? Do you remember?
700.
Seven.
I think, yep, ours was similar.
Yeah.
I remember.
But Naperville Central was the high school in the original. I mean, it's right near downtown. And it, like, when there was only one high school, it was just Naperville High School.
I remember watching the John Hughes movies where high schools were campuses and kids were walking to buildings and things like this. And I'm like, what? Like, this doesn't exist. This is a different world up there. There were 770 people in my entire high school, and you had 700 in your class.
Yep.
Different high school experience.
We rise above.
Yes.
A lot.
Yes.
So, being from the state of Illinois and the Chicago area, but you look at roster right now, Ohio, Florida, Australia, Elmhurst, Illinois, Missouri, Florida, Romania, New York City, Japan, and Virginia. And you mentioned in the past you've had athletes, you know, you needed somebody to talk. I mean, tennis is a very international sport nowadays. So what is the, how do you look at recruiting to Illinois, being from Illinois, as opposed to, I guess, just going to find the best players and the best fit for your program?
Sure. I think, every coach has a different philosophy. I would say for me, I've never really been super stuck on playing style. So sometimes it's more based on the makeup of the team. If there is a skill set that we're trying to add in, or if it's doubles or things like that, then that can be a little bit more of a tailored search. But really, we're trying to find people that are super competitive but also super caring. So it's an individual sport. So you want to make sure that obviously so much of this, their scheduling and just a lot of their experience is really tailored to them, so that they can adapt and be in now in this group mindset where it's like, hey, we're going to do what's best for the team to win. And so sometimes that means you're in a different position than you want to be, or maybe you're not number one, or just, you know, you want to just help the team in any way you can. So I think one, that's just one key piece. So we not only look at obviously their results and upside and just potential and athleticism, but also like, hey, after they lose their match, like, do they go cheer on their doubles partner after at nationals, or like, how do they talk to their parent after? Do they say thank you to the tournament desk? Like, there's other things that you can take a look at. And I think from a recruiting perspective is like, we want people that want to work really hard and get better and obviously can handle the academic load as well as the competitive side. And I think obviously our conference is so competitive, just people that are really resilient, and that, I mean, even when we had conversations, you know, leading up to taking on the program, is just saying like, obviously we want to win Big Ten championships, but we also have to realize like, it might be a tough year in the conference, but you can make a great run at NCAAs. And so I think just having that even experience at UCLA, like, we honestly almost never had a team goal to win regular season or to necessarily win the conference tournament. It was just, we want to win a national championship. And if there's a byproduct of winning the conference championship, great. So I think just people that are really willing to grow and be bold enough to go after things like that is really important. So again, sometimes that means taking on a technical change or different changes in their game that they need to do for the long-term development. And it's like, we would love for them to be from Illinois. That's even better, but we also are really open to across the world. So we just want people that fit those quality characteristics. And like I said, just can be a great team. We really want our team to be super tough, but also together. Like, if we're just, you know, I don't want it to just be an army of tennis players that can just deliver results and not actually enjoy their experience, because there's so many great things to enjoy about being here at Illinois that I want them to have that joy too. And in their career, as they get to be here and really feel like, yes, they get to be here. And it's not just something that they're doing just to check the box.
One question based on, you mentioned lineups there, and I've always been fascinated by this. You know, sometimes there's the theory of like, we'll take her and put her one. just maybe a better player. We'll put her two. She's better in that slot. There's these matchups with that team, this and that. I mean, again, going back to Southern Illinois high school tennis, you'd have those teams that, like, well, to beat them, we'll put our best guy at four, our second best guy at three. We'll try and win those two singles matches and then maybe steal some doubles points and all this kind of stuff. So how do you come out when you're setting a lineup? Is it like, this is our captain, this is our number one, we are locked in on that, and then from there? Or it's like, hey, we're going to move you guys around and that type of thing. How do you approach that?
Yeah, so still getting acclimated to in terms of lineup procedure within the conference. I believe they actually submit the week of. So One, just from the ITA and just in general with NCAA, is you have to be mindful of like playing to strength. Yes. So obviously you can't just move someone that would normally be six or seven and be like, oh, I'm deciding to put them at one this week.
We'll sacrifice them at right. one and then try and win the
Or
others.
You yes. can move usually by one spot. Uh-huh. So you have a little bit of room to move, especially sure. if someone's making a great run. I think really there's a lot of factors. So one, just different players have different mentalities. So I've had some players where they win 20 matches in a row and they lose one and it's like the end of the world. And so versus someone else might be a very similar level, but maybe they can play a one because if they win 60% of the time, they can still mentally stay really strong and feel really confident. So sometimes it's not only the level, but just how they operate as well, of just what works for them in terms of sustaining motivation, how easily if they have a loss, can they kind of move forward?
Sure.
And then sometimes there is game style things where we'll look at matchup if we have the ability to be flexible in the time frame we have, of just what makes sense of against who we're anticipating we're going to play. But I think also a great thing this happened at UCLA was it was a little bit more reliable. I think you could tell who you might play in the lineup. And so we did quite a bit really specific work leading up to those weekends of like, hey, I know I'm probably going to need this pattern. So we would do a ton of drilling and individuals on that pattern that we were anticipating going to need. So there's definitely things of that nature, but I would say I've always told the teams like, hey, we're going to do what's best for the team in the long run. And so sometimes in your individual world, that doesn't always make sense. And like I said before, I'm happy to give you a little bit more information if that will help you make sense of it.
Sure.
But just for them to realize, like, and I'll even tell sometimes a kid, hey, you won five matches in a row. I'm taking you out, not because you screwed up or that I don't believe in you, but like we have someone that's been injured. And if for some reason we have an injury in April or at NCAAs, I need to make sure that they're competitively ready. And this is an opportunity to plug them in, get some real quote match experience and not just an exhibition match. And where it's you're still going to be great if you come back in next week, and this is important for them. And so I think just having those realistic conversations with people, I think where we get into trouble is usually, I always say when there's a void of communication, that's when the made up stories come in. And so if you can really be as transparent and clear with your players, I think that's where they're like, okay, this is actually the truth of what's happening, and they don't need to guess what it is. And so I think that's where you can have a great player coach relationship with that piece and express those things where not only, you know, if there is something that they aren't doing as well, that you give them an opportunity to actually work on that and know what they can do better. And I think, honestly, at UCLA, my coach was sometimes it was hard to hear in the moment, but something I always talk about her was that she was super logical and she was always honest with me. So even if it was difficult for me to hear, she would tell me. And I think that's a great piece that we can still do with our players. I know sometimes there's hesitancy too, but I found that usually our players are really responsive to, I'm like, hey, like, I want to put you in. But when I look at the numbers right now, like, it's a losing record. So, or statistically, I've had a time where I had to, we changed it in the conference tournament and ended up winning the conference tournament. And I flipped one and two and moved a player into three. And I talked with them. I was like, I believe in you. I think you should be number one. But when I look at the numbers and when I look at the potential matchups in this tournament, I really, it makes sense to put you at two. And then we won the doubles point. So it's just, and then also the great thing is when it actually works out and they're like, okay, coach, yeah, you were right. I mean, that's always nice when it actually pays off.
Sure.
But I think those were just pieces where we were able to have those conversations. And in that same tournament, we had two players who had been out a lot during the season. And we had someone that was a little bit injured, had a discussion with them, and I was like, hey, you're going to go in. So all eight players got to participate because some played doubles versus singles, things like that, in the conference finals. And they'd been out of the lineup, but they were ready, and they knew that they could go in and compete and make sure that, you know, we could trust each other as well from a competitive side. And it was neat to see just that group of how they all got to play in that final match and get to NCAAs. So I think just when you're able to have that true conversation with them, they know what to work on, they know what kind of the metrics are that they're trying to shoot for, and that way it's just a little bit clearer line for them.
Well, I feel like I've been counseled very well here, so
yeah,
appreciate it. I know things are, even though it's a summer lull to the outside world, this is a big time of busyness and transition for you. So thank you so much for making some time for us. What is priorities for you between now and the start of the season in the fall?
I think for us, really, it's like people and processes. So we just want to make sure that our team's ready to go, that our support staff, that we're on board. So we have some more collaboration meetings of just setting the tone for what are things that work for the group, what are adjustments that we want to see. And so just making sure that the people feel like they're good coming in, that we have all the details that they need as well to have a good start. And then just having our schedule in line. Obviously, the great thing is we have just a lot of support staff to help me. I was typically the loan coach before, so it's nice to have people that I can talk with about, you know, their perspective of something, or also just to delegate things that I know they can handle really quickly. And so that's been exciting for me as well, because I think one of the fun parts of being a head coach is not only obviously the strategic side and the recruiting side, but also just big picture of how you want to dream and lead the group with vision. And so it's really neat to have people that can help me execute some of these things. I'm like, oh, this would be such a good idea. And to have the capacity to do that, I think is really amazing. So yeah, just really getting our people ready, making sure we have, again, the purpose behind the structure of what we're doing. And then if we need to adjust after the fall, we do, but at least we really know for the starting foundation of why we're doing things the way we do them.
Well, welcome to Champaign.
Thank you.
Good luck on the house hunt.
Yes, thank you.
Good luck on you getting all the craziness settled down and the kids in school and
yes,
and everything else. And we look forward to your season.
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, I'm going to tie this all together with Naperville.
Okay.
Naperville Central High School that Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson came from, my hometown's right near the Riverwalk in downtown Naperville, which is a masterclass for a landscape architect.
Okay. Never seen it, never heard of it, never, yeah, I don't think I've ever heard, I didn't know there's a river. There's a river in Naperville?
The DuPage River.
Sorry, I'm a St. Louis guy.
You could just hop on the DuPage River and make your way to the Mississippi eventually.
Okay.
That's not the point.
Okay.
Riverwalk is a big thing in Naperville.
Got it.
But there was a point when it wasn't so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is maybe even before my time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know who's from Naperville is Bob Odenkirk.
Mikey Dudek. What?
No, Bob Odenkirk.
Mikey, Bob Odenkirk. Better Call Saul.
Star of Better Call Saul, Simpsons writer fame, among other things. He's from Naperville.
Okay.
Well, there was a point, as I understand it, he was a writer on SNL.
Okay.
And he is the writer behind the famous Chris Farley Van Down by a River sketch.
Okay.
And in his mind, when he wrote that sketch, was the Riverwalk or an area right near it where back in the day, a bunch of ne'er-do-wells would just go hang out in a van down by the river.
So Van Down by the River was DuPage River in Naperville.
At least in Bob Odenkirk's mind. Mm-hmm. This was sort of the inspiration of it.
Okay.
So I like to think,
because
I told you that today's my wedding anniversary.
Yes.
My wife and I, as was the fashion at the time, wanted to do our photos before the ceremony so as to not, you know, make our guests wait all that time between the ceremony and the reception, especially on a Sunday, getaway day.
Mm-hmm.
So we did what the couples call first look.
Oh, yeah, where you like you turn around and you
see each other for the first time.
Since you're seeing each other before the wedding. Got it?
Yeah, which we did on a bridge at the Riverwalk right over the DuPage River.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some part of me that wonders, was that the bridge where they used to hang out in a van down by the river?
So you're saying it used to look trashy and then it got all landscape
architectured up. Some landscape architect came through there and cleaned up the joint.
That's right. That's
right. Other fun fact is Bob Odenkirk's wife is teaching at the University of Illinois this fall at the College of Law. And she's an alum.
Really?
Sarah Conley Odenkirk.
I did not know that.
There you go. It's all...
I was waiting for you to bring it back around to the eye, and you did.
I did.
You landed the plane. Wow.
Now you go. Now you know.
Well, maybe I should go to law school this fall and take a classroom.
I'll take you to Naperville, too.
Do you know how long I would last in law school? Listen, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
It's 23 years is... I don't want to say quite an accomplishment, but I do. I mean, it's that's great. 2 years away from the big 2-5.
Thanks to Kendall Crawford, our producer. Thanks to our guest, Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson. Thanks to our hosts at the Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning. For Robert Rosenthal, I'm Scott Beatty. We'll talk to you again next time when we light the eye.